Hi, I'm Chris Nessie from the House of EdTech podcast, a proud member of the Education Podcast Network, just like the show you're listening to right now. The opinions expressed are those of each individual host. And make sure to check out all the other great podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com. And now, the learning begins in 3, 2, 1.
Hey, today I'm talking with Bob Baird of fixmycareernow.com, and he's sharing his thoughts about job seeking, you know, resumes, cover letters, using LinkedIn, networking, questions during the interview, and so much more. Lots to learn. Enjoy.
You are listening to Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12. Podcast for educators, helping you help kids achieve their dreams. And now here's Steve with this week's show.
From professional musician to CEO of a 60-year-old nonprofit, Robert Bob Baird climbed the career ladder through a series of career pivots. Before becoming a CEO, he was a commander in the Navy Supply Corps, technology consultant for PricewaterhouseCoopers and IBM Business Services, a risk management consultant, and the Chief Information Officer, CIO, for a major insurance company. He successfully pivoted 12 times to obtain career success and is a career transition practitioner and expert. As a former C-level executive, hiring manager, and on occasion job applicant, he knows what management's looking for. He believes that finding a better, higher-paying job requires more than just a great resume and LinkedIn profile. You need a complete toolkit, which also includes networking, interviewing, and negotiation skills, to name a few. Say hi to everyone, Bob.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for having me, Steve.
Oh, I'm glad to have you here, and welcome, and looking forward to talking with you today.
Same here.
So let's back up a little bit before we look at career guidance. You were a professional musician. What instruments did you play in? What was that like? You know, what did you like about playing?
Yeah, well, I played guitar and sang 6 nights a week for 2 years on a restaurant hotel circuit in southern Michigan and northern Indiana. And I love performing. I was a voice major in college and had planned to be a teacher. And I enjoyed it, especially when the audience became engaged. I also have to say that I really love the travel and meeting new people.
Very cool. I'll bet you've met a lot of new people.
Yep.
Is that kind of a comfort zone for you, meeting new people, or does that have to help take you out of it, bring you into that world, or?
Oh, that's a great question. Actually, no. I think that I'm one of those introverts that's had to adapt and become an extrovert to become successful. And I would say that that started then with that very first job.
That's cool. So let's talk about the Navy. And thank you for your service to our country.
Certainly.
What is a Navy Supply Corps commander?
Yeah. Well, the Navy Supply Corps is the business component of the Navy. And we provide support in the areas of acquisition, procurement, finance, logistics, petroleum management, just to mention a few. And the Navy kind of chose me, as it turned out. I wanted to fly. I wanted to go into the Air Force. But unfortunately, I had uncorrectable vision, no depth perception, which they told me was dangerous. I don't really understand why, but they felt it was. And a recruiter happened to move in next door to my mother, and one thing led to another, and I was off on another career.
Gotcha. So what's funny is when I did the ASVAB in high school, for some reason, my scores told the Navy that they really should be talking to me about submarines. I'm not sure I understood that. That I wanted to be above ground and on the ground.
Well, that's fascinating that you mention that, because I spent most of my career in the submarine force.
Oh, very cool.
And my very first job was as the supply officer on the USS George Washington Carver, a fleet ballistic missile submarine.
That's awesome. How many crew are on a submarine like that you had to have supplies for?
Yeah, about 130 or so. We would have various riders that would go out with us for certain things, but about a few over 100.
Wow. So a nice community. And you stayed underwater for a good amount of time. So I guess
that is true.
So get to know each other, I guess is my point.
Very well.
What I was starting to think is that, you know, we're talking about career advancement and getting a different job and all that sort of stuff. And you start thinking about being underwater with people, the same people for 6 months. And after a while, I wonder what type of career guidance counseling comes into play there for the officers. But anyway, cool stuff. So what'd you like the most and what'd you like the least about being in the Navy?
Well, I certainly liked the professionalism of the submarine force. And I might be a bit parochial or partial here, but I really think it's unparalleled anywhere else. It's a community of volunteers who do something very complex and difficult, and they do it extremely well. So I really enjoyed that. And then my last job in the Navy, I was actually the business manager for the new Joint Strike Fighter, what is known as the F-35 jet. So I had financial responsibility for that program, and it's just an amazing aircraft, and it was really, really cool to be a part of that. I would say what I liked the least about all of this was time away from family, which everyone who's ever served can understand.
Well, I can only imagine with being completely away like that. So awesome. Well, thank you for sharing. And so what I'd like to do is let's kind of shift into the more modern times. So you recently retired from the corporate world and you're mm-hmm. seeking now to help people get a higher paying job or career. And on your website, you have this statement: a person changes jobs an average of 12 times during their career. Why do you think so many times?
Well, I think the old days of loyal companies and therefore loyal employees are gone. And also my observation is that to advance, moving out of your current organization almost always becomes necessary, especially if you're part of a smaller organization. You know, the opportunities to advance aren't just there. So you have to move laterally and slightly up to move forward. I would also say that there are a lot of college graduates who, for whatever reason, make the wrong career choice. I was a music major and wound up as a CIO. So, I know that. But if you're like me, you can reposition yourself, whether it be through lateral movements to get better jobs or whether it be complete career choices. You know, I went from musician to CEO of a nonprofit. And I have to tell you that in the beginning, I never thought that's where I was going. But I will have to say that I'm a much richer person for all the experiences I've had.
Well, I can imagine, you know, being from musician to being a commander in the Navy, just alone, that transition there, as you would rise up through the ranks and be in charge of people and over the logistics and so forth, that in itself, and then going into the corporate world, I would think you kind of learn a lot about those types of transitions that you have to make in order to be successful.
That's right.
Very cool stuff. So what do you think is one thing that causes a person to fail at changing or switching jobs, fields, or companies?
I don't know how many folks actually fail. I think it may, you know, success may be delayed a bit, or it may not turn out exactly the way you'd hoped. But I do say that it's not easy to do. And that's the case because it requires many skills you may not possess or be very good at because you do it so seldom. The job search process is just that. It's a process. It's a collection of activities that require certain skill sets. And there's much more to it than just writing a resume. And some of those other elements include writing, marketing, communicating, interviewing, performing company research, networking, interviewing, and even negotiating compensation. So that's an awful lot of skills that one must have to be successful. And it's probably surprising anyone's ever successful, given how complex it is. But all those things can be learned. And through one way or another, people do learn how to do these things, and they are successful eventually.
Very cool. Do you think sometimes we get in our own ways? I don't know. I guess where I'm going with this is just the idea that, we start thinking, can I really do this?
Should I really certainly. Do this? Yeah, certainly. I mean, self-doubt can often enter into it, especially if it's a career transition. But I would think that those who have not changed jobs three or four times Every one of those is a huge deal. And I'm sure that there's a lot of uncertainty and fear and doubt that enters into that. And the way to overcome that is to develop these skills, you know, whether that be through your career development center at your school, if you're still in college, or whether it be all of the resources that are available on the internet, or in some cases, maybe seeking out a career coach.
Excellent. One of the things I'd like to do now is kind of, as we start getting a little more specific into what it is that you advise and do. And, you know, in a webinar that you created, I heard you say that you have to have a resume to get you past a gatekeeper, a gatekeeper that might not even be human. Can you talk about this just a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Things have changed a lot over the last, I don't know, it's probably been about 15 years, but certainly in the last 5 years. And that is, most companies of any size, and certainly I would bet this is school districts and those who hire teachers, are using what is known as an applicant tracking system, or an ATS. And this system essentially holds any correspondence you submit to that company. So that might be your resume, it might be a cover letter, it might be any email you've sent, and it holds that. And then when the hiring manager is looking to hire someone, they and the HR director get together, and using usually the position description, they establish criteria for the applicants that are in that system that they want to pop out. Basically on a search. And what they're looking for are keywords. And I'm sure many of your listeners have heard about this. The resume keywords are how you get found. In other words, if you don't have the right keywords in your resume is never coming out of the applicant tracking system. So that applicant tracking system becomes a gatekeeper. And in fact, it's not human. And there's ways of making your resume score higher and get out of the ATS when they're doing a job search, but it requires resume keyword optimization and also keyword optimization in your cover letter and in your LinkedIn profile. And if you're not doing that, your resume may simply become invisible to that organization.
Wow. So some of the keywords might be like making sure that you use the position or the actual name that they listed under, that type of thing. And more specifically, maybe some of the duties or the responsibilities of the position.
Yeah, absolutely. And the way I teach one to find the right keywords is to get the position description. And then I'm sure most of your listeners are knowledgeable about what we call word clouds,
yes,
where you can put a bunch of words into a computer program and it kicks out those words that appear more often. I would take that position description, put it in a word cloud generator and have it tell me which are the most important words in that position description. And those are the ones I would make sure are in my resume and in key places, the heading right up at the top. I mean, so you're not what we call keyword stuffing, but you're strategically placing keywords such that your resume still reads well. Because ultimately, if the ATS does find your resume amongst all the thousands that are in there, someone is going to read it.
Right.
So in the end, it has to be readable. But at first, it has to be findable or it won't be read.
Gotcha. That makes sense. It's just you kind of wish you were trying to get a human's attention, I think.
Yeah, times have changed.
Very much so. So probably one of the most problematic procrastination-inducing requirements of job searching is that cover letter you're talking about. You know, it's one of the things, yeah. I know in my own world, I've, you know, you start the letter and you go, I think I'll work on my resume a little bit. You come back to the letter, I think I'll work on my, you know. You start finding reasons to do other parts of the job search other than that letter. And eventually it comes down to, look, are you going to get the letter done or not? Can you talk a little bit about writing good cover letters, some of the stuff that needs to be in there?
Yeah, absolutely. And the first thing I would say is that there are three key documents when you're looking for a job. Certainly the resume and the LinkedIn profile and the cover letter. And they each have a different purpose. And it helps to remember this. The resume proves that you are qualified. That's all it does. The cover letter creates a personal connection with the hiring manager, or attempts to, and asks for the interview. Nowhere else do you have an interview, what we call call to action. You don't do it in your resume. If you don't ask for the interview in your cover letter, you're not asking for an interview. And you might think, well, you know, it's just kind of understood that if I send them a resume that I'll want an interview, but it doesn't hurt to ask. Calls to action work. And then the last is a LinkedIn profile. And this is where you communicate your personal brand. And your personal brand is who you are, what you stand for, and what you want. And this is where you really get to talk to a person in English, right? Not bullets that are abbreviated in, right, you know, third person. This is where you get to say, hey, this is who I am. This is what I believe, and this is what I want. And if you're looking for somebody like this, I'm the one. You can say that just like that in your LinkedIn profile, but you can't do it anywhere else. And you can do it a little bit in your cover letter too, and should. But let me give you some interesting facts here. You know, it's true that 90% of hiring managers don't read cover letters. So you have to ask, well, why in the heck do we write them? Well, 53% prefer that we send them to them. And we don't know which 53% they are. So you have to write a cover letter, because chances are half of the hiring managers you send them to will read them. 48% of them will toss them out if they're not personalized. So I'm going to talk about this in a second. And then again, much like resumes, 50 to 70% will toss them out if they find spelling errors or grammatical errors. So cover letters nowadays aren't like probably what you and I remember. They were typed out on a typewriter, if you remember what that is, or a computer, and then you printed it and you mailed it, right?
Right.
Nowadays, they are emails. Cover letters are the email you type that says, my resume is attached. Okay, that's your cover letter now. And the first thing you need to do before you write that cover letter is you need to research the company or the school district or the specific school you want to work for and personalize your message to the hiring manager. So you have this chance to create this personal connection. So the research is the starting point. Once you've done that, again, make sure you don't use a template or a copy and paste. This is where you elaborate on your resume, but you don't summarize your resume. And the last thing in the cover letter, the last paragraph should be the call to action. You know, I would love to interview for this position. Please call me or I will call you. You know, something like that, but very clearly asks for the interview.
Gotcha. And I think sometimes we probably are cautious or worry that asking is too much. I mean, you think that's too forward?
Right.
I mean, some people worry it's too forward, I guess.
You got to get over that.
You don't get what you don't ask for, right?
There's some truth in that. Yes.
I gotcha. Cool. So you've mentioned a couple times that it seems important that a job seeker, you know, go ahead and establish that LinkedIn profile. Why do you think that's so important?
Yeah. What I would say to your listeners is that, and this is not that well known, I guess, is that LinkedIn is probably the largest job search engine, even larger than Indeed. I mean, everything that's on LinkedIn is searchable by recruiters, and they pay good money to be able to find your profile when they're looking for someone. And most recruiters in this day and age, when there is, I don't know if your listeners know this, but we're in the best job market ever. There are more jobs than there are job applicants. So your competition in most areas, not across the board, but in most areas, there's not a lot of competition for the jobs that are out there. Now, that's very different if you're just out of school and you're trying to establish yourself as a teacher and get started. I get that. I know a lot of college graduates who are teachers, and it wasn't easy, but it's better now than it's been in 10 years. So what I'd like to say is that recruiters are searching for candidates, whether the candidates are looking for the jobs. We call this passive candidates or passive recruiting. And most companies are doing this. They're trying to find people and do what we call poach them away from their existing jobs. My daughter was poached away from her job by a recruiter. And so that's done on LinkedIn. So it's important if you want to be seen and you want someone to find you when that amazing job comes along, that you have a strong LinkedIn profile. And it's really your chance, as I mentioned before, to connect to that hiring manager in a very personal way and explain your personal brand. Again, resumes can't do any of this. And so once your resume pops out of that applicant tracking system, if you've done everything right, they're going to run to LinkedIn to look you up, if nothing else, to see your picture. So make it a good one. But LinkedIn goes hand in hand with the resume and the cover letter.
Excellent. That's it. And in this, you know, tech savvy world that we're in now, I would think that it also shows that you've got some sort of, you've at least can do something out there in the technology, the current world that it is.
Very true.
So let's talk about something else that kind of goes along with the job seeking process, which a lot of times scares a lot of people, and it's networking. You know, oftentimes job seekers who are having a difficult time changing jobs or getting a job will comment, you know, I just don't know anyone who can help me. How can they go about connecting with others that might lead them to a job opportunity? And why should they want to do this?
Yeah, let me start with a why should they do this question.
All right.
I once had a marketing professor, and he said, if you ever have to write a resume, you've failed. You know, he didn't mean this literally, but his point was that if you are always networking and helping others all the time, then when you need a job, your network will take care of you. And if you master networking, you'll rarely be out of work looking for a job. And he's right. What we know is that the figure isn't exact, but around 60% of all jobs are never posted. This is called the hidden job market. These are jobs that companies have or are contemplating having that they find applicants through referrals, employee referrals, or they find them in other ways. But they don't even go to the job boards. And you won't know about these jobs unless your network makes you aware of it. So those are the two big reasons, I think, why networks are so important.
That's excellent. You know, and it's like you said, a lot of times what happens is that you've been working with people that you never even realized that at some point they may come back to you and say, hey, I just thought that you might be interested in this.
Absolutely.
Which is a cool thing. So just by being out there with people. So cool stuff. So, you know, in the networking, I mean, I know one of the things that you did is you have at your website, you have and by the way, I'll have any websites or links to any of places where you can find Bob. I'll have them linked in my show notes, so you don't have to write them down as you're driving out there listening to us or whatever you're doing. So we got, you know, in a blog article that you wrote about networking, you talk about following your three P's: prepare, practice, provide. Can you explain this in terms of networking?
Yeah, sure. And if you remember, I started out as an introvert, and I don't know that ever went away entirely. The whole notion of networking to me felt like schmoozing, and that just felt wrong. But that's not what it is. It really isn't. So in order to get over this introversion that I had to create a way to accomplish that, and that's where I developed the strategy. And the first is to prepare. And so what I mean by that is everyone who's listening who will ever look for a job, so I guess it's everyone, needs to create a short list of literally everyone they know, whether this be family or friends, past coworkers, fraternity and sorority brothers and sisters, certainly every teacher you know or have known, right? Because this is your starting point for building your network. And if you know things like 6 degrees of freedom, you know, by connecting with one person, you may wind up connected to many, many more. And so by starting with this short list or seeding your networking, process, you will grow your network. So that's the first step of the prepare, part of the strategy. The second part is to know what you're looking for and to be able to express that when others ask, or maybe even when they don't ask. And the way you do this is through what I call an elevator pitch. And it is definitely critical for face-to-face networking encounters like job fairs, career expos, networking events. And the term elevator pitch and elevator speech are actually synonymous, but they refer to the time it would take to ride an elevator from the lobby to the top of a building when you might have that opportunity to impress someone. And this is considered to be somewhere between 30 and 90 seconds. So this is a very rehearsed pitch that rolls off your tongue anytime you need it, which, oh, by the way, and I know this from personal experience, happens a lot more than you would think. I have an entire blog devoted to developing the elevator pitch, so I won't go into it in a lot of detail. But your elevator pitch explains to people kind of who you are, something interesting you've done, and kind of where you're at. And it doesn't say, hey, I need a job. Okay. But it makes it known to folks that you might be open to opportunities. Let me say that. So what you're trying to do with an elevator pitch is to get the person you're speaking to take an interest in you. And so that's an important part. So that's step two of the prepare component of the strategy. So the first was create your short list so you know who you're going to want to talk to. And the second part is to develop your elevator pitch. Then the second part of the strategy is to practice. Now, at events, say a conference or a job fair, this takes the form of a conversation, something like, hi, my name is Bob Baird. What's yours? Well, you're Steve. Well, where are you from, Steve? How was your trip here? What are you hoping to get out of the conference? Have you come to the conference before? Do you go to similar conferences? This is my first time. Do you have any recommendations? In other words, I haven't talked about jobs at all. This is not schmoozing. I'm just talking and creating a relationship. Now, if this is by phone or email, let's say you have a short list of teachers and you want to reach out to your math teacher from the eighth grade, you might say, hey, you know, use your elevator pitch here and tell them who you are and what you're doing and how things have gone and catch up with them. But don't ask about the job. You might ask them if they happen to be aware of any openings or know some, more importantly, know someone who might have a lead. And if so, could they make an introduction? And this is where your network begins to grow. So it's a very gentle kind of a letter that you would write to someone on your short list. And here's the key to all of this. And this is the third part of the three P's, and that is provide. And this is great networkers do this very, very well. And I think if you think back about those you know who have been great networkers, you'll see that this is what they were doing. What they were doing was giving, not taking. Giving is always better than receiving, as we know, but it's also good business. You will have much stronger networks if you give. And if you believe in karma, need I say more? So this is how it works. You listen to the other person and you look for any problems they may have to see if you might know of any solutions. Now, this might come in the way of research you've seen or a name of a colleague who's an expert, you might refer to them. Or if you meet them at an event, it might just be a ride to the airport. But you're trying to find a way to provide something to that individual. And that's how you begin to create a lasting relationship with someone based on trust and not simply an encounter that asks for a job. This is a meaningful relationship that will last a lifetime, and that's a real network.
That's cool. That's and I think a lot of times, you know, sometimes we don't realize the people that we have interacted with, and that might, you know, not even realize that you have somebody who you should think of as part of your network. And I think that can create some, you know, just, oh, I didn't think about that, I guess is my point. Oh, I could talk to him. You know, I don't know.
It could be your grandmother. Your grandmother may know someone who has a daughter who's a teacher. And next thing you know, you have a job. So
basically, get on the role of figuring out networking and start practicing. That is what you're saying.
I am.
Yes. Excellent. So let's do this now. You know, basically, now the job seeker gets an interview, and one of the things that we have to anticipate are the questions that they'll ask, as well as how we should be in the interview and stuff like this. Because, you know, of course, that's what we're hoping we get is an interview. And then right. Hopefully we don't blow it because we just totally mess up, or we just don't do what we thought we should. You know, we practiced the wrong thing or whatever. But, you know, one of the things that what is one question that the candidate really needs to develop an answer for?
That's a great question, Steve, in of itself. I will tell you that the number one question you can be sure you will be asked, and probably at the opening of the interview, is actually not a question, but a request. But it should be treated like a question. And it's the old, tell me about yourself request. It's really a question. The reality is most interviewers are not good at interviewing. They don't do it often enough to be good at it. And some ask this question or this request because they think they should. They've heard others do it. And others ask it because they really want to know if you're going to start revealing interesting personal things about your life, which is exactly what you don't want to do. And by the way, they don't want to hear it either. Especially the people who ask this question, not knowing what kind of response they would get, and then they get the one they don't want. So how do you answer this? And there is an excellent way, and only one way, to answer the tell me about yourself question. And that is, well, certainly. And thanks for asking. And as you can see from my resume, I've had the chance to do some pretty amazing things in my career, such as X, Y, and Z. And as I understand it, you're looking for someone like me who can do ABC. And I'm confident I'd be a good fit here and your team, which is why I'm so excited about working here.
That's awesome.
You're telling them about yourself, but in the context of this position.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And you're telling them the most important things about yourself, why you're the person they can't pass on, why they have to hire you. That's the right answer to this question. You don't want to waste a minute in an interview. I have a blog where I talk about taking offense on an interview. You should be in control of your own interviews. You should never feel like the interviewer is in control. You should know exactly what you want to get across in that interview, and you should make sure that their questions lead to your answers. You want to make sure that you get your message across.
Gotcha. That's awesome advice. That, you know, it's funny because I've been in a couple of interviews where they threw you because it was like, just like you said, many times they don't do it enough and they don't know what, so, you know, if they fail to practice, you figure that out too, which can throw you off just as well. And so I think that advice about staying on the offense would be how you overcome that when they throw you off because they don't ask or there's some weird personal thing happening between a couple of the people on the team or whatever, and staying on the offense would probably help overcome that as well.
Yeah. And Steve, you've probably been in an interview where the interviewer started talking about themselves.
Yes.
And most of the interview was all about them.
Yes,
and very little about you. Now, you might say, boy, that sure was a great interview because I didn't have to answer any questions. But it wasn't. You're not going to get hired. So, again, you have to take offense on the interview. And you have to be diplomatic and you have to be careful, of course. But you want to make sure that your message comes across and not theirs.
Excellent advice. I love that. That's just going through any, you're making me think of several interviews that I've been on that wish it had gone different ways and wish I'd had that advice at the time. So good stuff. So let's talk and continuing to talk about the interview. You know, they also usually give you a chance to ask a question or two.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any advice on preparing for this?
Yeah. First, I would make sure you're prepared to answer 3 to 5 questions or prepared to ask 3 to 5 questions.
Okay.
And the reason I say this, and I'm sure you've experienced this, Steve, is that during the course of the interview, some of those questions you have on your list may get answered. And you certainly don't want to ask them after they've already been answered.
Right.
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 And I've seen most of my questions disappear during the course of an interview. And literally, I found myself at the interview saying, oh, my God, I know I need to ask a question. What'll it be? But you do need to ask questions at the interview, at the end of the interview. If you're not, it will be looked poorly upon you. So one great question I love, and it's a very useful question, and it may decide whether or not you really want to work there, is can you describe a typical day for this position? What does my day look like? And have them tell you what you would do, because you may find out that, ooh, I don't want to do that. This is not the job for me. So it's not just a question to throw it out because you need to ask a question. It's a question that actually provides you with useful information. Another is, can you describe the culture of this organization? Because it may not be your culture, you know?
Yeah.
So those are the types of questions I would come up with, questions that are very, very unlikely to be answered during the course of the interview, but definitely have questions to ask.
Excellent advice. Yeah, I like that, talking about what you might expect. And what popped into my brain was the Navy and submarines. So So what might we expect out of this if I joined the Submariner crew? Good stuff. So something I want to, you know, as we're talking, I wanted to kind of get around to, because I know you also talk about a lot of times people don't negotiate their salary. Could you talk just a little bit about where you go with that and what your advice is there?
Yeah. The advice is you should always attempt to negotiate your salary. And I have a lot of advice on that in a very recent blog that's on my website. But what I would say is the question at the end, the simple question, do you think you could do better? Or, yeah, it's amazing how often something as simple as that will result in an increase in salary.
Wow.
So you have to ask. In fact, most employers expect you to negotiate. Believe it or not, they expect you to negotiate. You may not feel that way, especially if you're new, if you're new to the workforce, but they do expect you to attempt to negotiate. The other thing I would also say is negotiation is not just about salary, and you know this. It's about the entire compensation package, whether there are work for home hours, how much vacation time, whether there's a 401k, match. There's many, many elements of the compensation package which also matter. And sometimes when they can't negotiate salary, they will negotiate some of these other things. The other thing to remember is that although it's quite possible in many situations to negotiate a 10% increase, and I'm being conservative, it would take you at least 4 years to get that 10% in annual pay raises.
Wow.
You have the opportunity at the negotiating table when you're being hired that you won't ever get again, and you need to take advantage of it. And all they can say is no.
Right. we don't negotiate. Well, fine. Can't hurt to ask, right? I like
That's
that.
Right. That's right.
I like that. So as we're drawing to a close, I want to make sure that I ask you, if a listener would like to reach out to you, what would be the best way?
Well, sure. Through my website, and I understand that'll be in your show notes,
yes.
fixmycareernow.com. I have a contact form there. And I've also written, as I mentioned, many articles on the issues we've talked about today, as well as some others. I think you mentioned I currently have a free webinar on the whole resume and the applicant tracking system and keywords that they can watch. And they can always reach out to me, my email. And my email address is bob@robertbaird.us. That's bob@robertbaird.us. And I'd be happy to talk with your listeners.
Excellent. I appreciate you being available to them. And I'll make sure that everything is linked in my show notes, as well as you'll also have his email address right there also. So here's my last two questions. You know, my audience is comprised of teachers and educators of all sorts and building administrators and district administrators and media specialists and so forth. You know, if you were given the chance to talk with 100 brand new teachers who haven't started teaching yet and they're seeking their first teaching position, what advice would you give them?
Three things. First, and I know this because I surveyed 100 of my followers and found that this answer was a little hard to believe, is that they seek out whatever training their college or university career development center may have and whatever support they may provide. Like I said, I surveyed my followers and found out how few had taken advantage of what they had essentially paid for. Second, I would make sure you create that short list now of others that might assist you and begin to build your network. It's like saving for your retirement. The longer you put it off, the worse it is. You need to start building your network from the very beginning. And some of your best contacts are going to be the ones you're going to school with and the ones you've been taught by. They can be lifelong members of your network. And that's a great place to start. After that, it gets a little more difficult. You don't have near as many people around you. And then the last thing I would say, especially to those just leaving school, is remember that you are going to have multiple jobs and possibly even multiple careers throughout your life. And in the beginning, taking a job that will lead to better things later may be the right choice, even if it isn't the perfect job. It isn't always, I'll be quite frank with your listeners, when we're starting out, we're more beggars than we are choosers. And we have to do as well as we can, but keep in mind the long game and where you want to go and whether this opportunity might provide something useful to get you to your end goal.
Oh, that's excellent advice right there. That's wonderful, because I think sometimes we just get caught up in the idea that everything is, you know, forever, and this is, you know, the most awesome thing, and am I going to lose this? Am I going to, you know, get all these strange thoughts in our minds when we start looking at when we're in the job market and stuff like this. And I think sometimes, you know, that just what you're talking about is, you know, keeping in mind that that's not necessarily the case. We may end up changing again.
Yeah, that's right.
Finding something that's a better match. So
yeah, statistics tell us quite a few times.
Very cool. Well, Bob, thank you so much for sharing your career advice. And you know, you've got Fix My Career Now that's available out there on the website, where you have help for everyone, and you have a YouTube channel that I'll link to, as well as your website where they can reach out to you for some help and read your blog and your suggestions there. You know, I can't thank you enough for joining me today. You have incredible advice and suggestions for helping out job seekers and those wanting to change their careers. And I encourage my listeners to check out your website, fixmycareernow.com. Best wishes to you, Bob.
Thank you, Steve.
Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is excited to be a member of Voice Ed Radio. Voice Ed Radio, your voice is right here. Teaching, Learning, Leading K-12 is a proud member of the Education Podcast Network. Podcasts for educators, podcasts by educators. The opinions expressed on Teaching Learning Leading K-12 are those of the guests and host. Teaching Learning Leading K-12 is intended to share ideas, advice, and suggestions for classroom teachers and school administrators. Teaching Learning Leading K-12 is produced for educational purposes. Thanks for listening, and I hope you'll share it with your friends.